We got another Q&A edition today where I'll be talking about the Social Security earnings test, Social Security survivor benefits, a couple questions about 401k and solo 401k, and tax gain harvesting in this, the 48th episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Okay. Welcome back, everyone. Another question and answer edition, Retirement Planning Education. I have a few good questions today, a couple Social Security, a couple 401k, and one about tax gain harvesting. Real live question slash scenario I just went through with a client. So here, you know, this is a fresh one, a real one. Before that, I wanted to make a random comment. So yesterday was a first for me. I went to a concert by myself. Drumroll. I guess that's not drumroll, but whatever. There's this band called Trampled by Turtles that is a bluegrass folksy band out of Duluth, Minnesota. And I've been a kind of casual fan for a few years. They have a new album out and it got me sort of like re-engaged in fandom for them. And I happened to look, oh, let me see if they're touring anywhere. And lo and behold, they're playing near me. They're playing in Webster Hall in New York City, which is relatively close. I don't know, hour for me. And then also the Fillmore in Philadelphia, which is also an hour, but you know that would be opposite direction. So I'm more a fan of going to Philadelphia than I am New York. So I chose to see them in Philadelphia. So anyway, so I went last night, went by myself. My wife's not particularly interested in that. It's a little too bluegrassy for her, which I get. But it was good. So I don't know where I'm going with this, but sort of proud of myself. I thought it was weird to go to a show or a movie by yourself. But now I'm like, you know what? I get it. I completely get it. It was fine. I had a good time. I got a shirt. I got a poster, got a couple beers. I made friends with the guy next to me who lives not too far away from me. Actually, we worked in the same industry. So it was a really good time. And it was a cool venue. If anyone's listening, has in the Philadelphia area, has not yet been to the Fillmore, it is a really cool place to see a show. I did get a seat. I'm not interested in standing. The place is mostly general admission standing only, but there's a balcony up top. And I paid to get a balcony seat. I'm one of those guys who just sits down and soaks it in that way. I don't want to be standing up on the floor and whatever. So it was cool. I'll leave it there. If you're interested, Trampled by Turtles. It is a mandolin, a fiddle, a banjo, guitar, a bass, and a cello. And all six guys are in all songs or most of the songs. It's really, really cool if you're into that kind of mix of strings. All right. One other musical thing. So Zeppelin. I mentioned last episode some comments about Led Zeppelin. And surprisingly, I got a lot of feedback about that. Good feedback. Sort of like, you know, shooting the breeze feedback. That's pretty cool. So people actually do listen to this and do, I guess some of you at least, like these off-the-cuff comments. So yeah, Zeppelin's probably my favorite band or one of them. And I like some of the off the beaten path, slower stuff of theirs, like Tangerine is probably my favorite song or one of my favorite songs of theirs. Hey, What Can I Do? Going to California. This is going to be blasphemous, but a lot of their popular songs I think are way overrated. Cashmere, completely overrated. Whole Lot of Love. I get why people like it, but I don't know. I turn it off whenever it's on. Don't know why, just me. But anyway, I'll leave that there. I don't know where I'm going with that, but thought I'd talk about some Zeppelin some more. Okay, let's get into the questions. So we have five today. First one, it's been a while. This one's been in my inbox for a while. Finally getting to it. Ed from Virginia. Thank you, Ed, and thank you for your patience here. So here goes it. I will read from Ed. Da-da-da. Currently, I'm 54 years old. My wife will be 49 years old when I turn 62. We will have a 10-year-old son when I turn 62. I plan on taking Social Security at age 62, allowing my wife and son to collect benefits as well. My wife will be caring for a dependent until he turns 16, and my son's dependent benefits until he is 18, up to our family max. Hold that thought. I'll come back to what that means. Ed continues on. If my wife and I both work part-time during these years, is the Social Security earnings limit of 19 plus thousand or whatever it is in 2030 when I turn 62, is that for both of us or combined, or do we each get to make up to, you know, 19 plus thousand dollars before benefits are withheld? How about my son when he begins working at age 16? Do all three of us have to earn below 19 plus thousand? How about when my wife no longer collects the benefit because my son has turned 16? Can she go back to earning whatever she wants? Or because we file married joint, does she need to stay below $19,000+? Thank you for any help you can provide on this little known and little covered topic for our somewhat rare situation, a retiree with a minor child. Thank you. Yes, great question, Ed from Virginia. You are right. This is sort of lesser talked about, lesser known, one of the more, I don't want to say nuanced benefits of Social Security, but probably less utilized, let's say that. So a few things to discuss, and I'll say unpack, I guess. You mentioned something called, let's kind of go in order here. You mentioned something called the family max. So what that means is anyone who earns benefits, as you all know, you can get a retirement benefit from Social Security. You can, spouses can also get benefits off your record. So if you're married, your spouse can potentially get a spousal benefit off of your Social Security record. You can still get your own benefit. Your spouse can get a benefit off you as well. Additionally, it's not just spouses, but also children, dependent children. It's under age 16 or up to age 16. I forget the exact cutoff. Actually, it's up to 18, I think, or below 18. I forget the cutoff there. But dependent children can get child benefits off of the wage earner. Now, to your point, Ed, this isn't a situation that applies to everyone, because it would require the primary record holder, the earner, if you will, to be at least 62 and getting his or her own benefits, and then have a child that is not yet of 18 or whatever the age is. I forget. So so retirees with minor children isn't a tremendously common scenario, which is why a lot of people don't think about this, don't know about it. But children are eligible to get benefits off their parents if, you know, the ages work out. So there's something called the family max, though. So let's assume you have 10 kids. Each kid can get a benefit off of your record, as can your spouse, as can you. But the benefits are capped. I forget the exact formula for it, but there's a range all in. The total benefits that can be pulled off your record are limited to, I want to say, like 1.8 times your full retirement amount, your primary insurance amount, which is your full retirement age benefit, if I remember correctly. I looked into this before. I knew it at one time. It's incredibly nuanced, so I didn't go back to research the full calculation. But to the gist of your question, yes, everyone's benefit. You can have a dozen different family members getting benefits off your record. They'll all collectively be capped at this 1.8 times, and each family member's benefit will be prorated down. It's not like one or two members will get their full benefits. Everyone else gets pennies. No, everyone's like has their benefit reduced, prorated. So that's the family max. Next question was about the earnings limit. So if you are under your full retirement age and you're getting benefits, whether it's your own or spousal benefits or child benefits or survivor benefits, in the case of the primary earner has passed, if you are under your full retirement age and getting benefits and working, there's something called the earnings test, which may come into play. This number changes every year. They just announced it for 2023. I don't have it in front of me. It's $20,000+, but this changes every year. So, the specifics don't really matter this year, because by the time someone is listening, you know, it applies to them, it's going to be some different year, some different amount. But Ed, you referenced $19,560, which I believe is the 2022 earnings limit. So if you are 62, let's say, you're getting your own benefits, as Ed will be doing in this example. And let's assume the earnings test limit for that year is $19,560. Ed can make up to total earnings or self-employment income of $19,560 with no reduction at all for the Social Security benefit he's getting. Once you start making more than that, for every $2 you make over, your benefit will reduce by $1. Or another way to think about it, every dollar you make, your benefit's reduced by 50 cents. So you can do the math here. The more you make over that limit, the more your benefit will be reduced and could be potentially wiped away completely. You know, if you're making 200 grand, you're way over this earnings test limit, it will reduce your benefit down to, down to zero. But not all is lost for what it's worth. I don't want to get too off on a tangent about the earnings test, but when your benefit is reduced, it's not like it's irrevocably gone. What functionally happens is for every month, there is a reduction to your benefit because of this earnings test. It tacks on a month to your claiming age, such that when you hit full retirement age, it'll be as if you started a month later than you actually did. So in your case, Ed, you're starting at 62, right? As early as you can start. When you hit full retirement age, you'll be credited with an additional month as if you delayed till 62 in 1 month, basically. Your benefit will be recalculated then. So every month you have the earnings test reduce your benefit, you get another sort of a month of delay tacked on to your benefit when you turn full retirement age, such that your benefit will now increase. Eventually, if you live long enough, you will make it up. You know, all these earnings test reductions you had prior to full retirement age, you will make it up if you live long enough. If you don't, you don't make it up, unfortunately. That's just another one of those oddity, sort of not necessarily fair things about the earnings test. But to your question was, is this $19,560 or whatever it is in the given year earnings test apply collectively to the family or to each person? It's each person. So you can work, Ed, you can make up to 19,560. Your wife can make up to 19,560 before her benefit gets reduced. And your child, if your child starts working, he or she can make up to 19,560 before his or her child benefit starts getting reduced. Again, child benefits stop at, I want to say 17 or 18. The reason why I mentioned 16 is your spouse is younger than normal age to get a spousal benefit, but if she's caring for a child who's 16 or under, or maybe it's up to 16, again, I forget the cutoff, then she can also get a spousal benefit for caring for that child in addition to the child getting a benefit. So anyway, so the earnings test is by individual. So each of you three can make up to 19,560 or whatever the earnings test limit will be in 2030. You know, it's probably going to be 30 grand, maybe more. At the time, because it's adjusted for inflation every year. You then go on, how about when my wife no longer collects a benefit because my son has turned 16? Can she go back to earning whatever she wants? So I guess you answered the question for me, which I didn't know. It sounds like once the child is 16, not including 16, once the child turns 16, the spouse caring for that child can no longer get the spousal benefit. So then yes, if she's no longer getting a benefit because she's too young to get her own benefit or her normal spousal benefit at that point, it's no longer like a child and care benefit. Yes, she can work, make as much as she wants. She's not going to benefit. Doesn't matter. It'll only start to matter again once she turns 62, and starts getting her own benefit or normal spousal benefits off of you. Then the earnings test will come back into play for her at that time. Ed, and let's see. Okay. I think I covered all of that. Long one, a lot of little offshoots there, but there's a lot of moving parts here. So hopefully I answered it. Apologies, I did not. It would be easy enough for me to look these up. I don't know why I didn't. But the cutoffs for how old a child has to be for the spouse to get child benefits, or you know, to get child care benefits, or even the child himself or herself, how old they have to be to get their own. I think once a child turns 18, they're no longer eligible. Or if they're still in high school, I think it can be up to 19, if I remember correctly. Okay. Good question, Ed. Thank you for that. Next, what do we got here? Next is from Krishnan. Krishnan asks, let's see, I have a few things here. So Krishnan is referencing the recent solo 401k video I did with Sean Mullaney in my Facebook group, Taxes and Retirement. I posted that video up on YouTube, which is where Krishnan saw it. Krishnan is not on Facebook, so he didn't see it there, but he is thankful that the videos from Facebook are posted up on YouTube, which the whole world has access to without needing any sort of membership. Anyway, so Krishnan asks, what are the implications for a required minimum distribution aged individual with a consulting gig? Unlike IRAs, both traditional 401ks and Roth 401ks have required minimum distribution requirements. But there's also the still working for the same employer exception. Still true for the solo version? Great question, Krishnan. So what Krishnan is referencing is, If you are, so required minimum distributions or RMDs typically start under current legislation, the year you turn 72, you need to take out a certain amount of money from your tax deferred accounts. Because they're tax deferred, the government basically let you kick the can down the road long enough to like, okay, pay me now. Like they force you to start taking money out. Specifically, you have to start paying tax on that money you take out. So that's a required minimum distribution. And again, it starts the year you're 72 under current legislation. There's an exception though. If you are working for an employer and you have a 401k, for example, at that employer, you do not need to take a required minimum distribution from that employer's 401k, so long as you're still employed there. you do still need to take RMDs from IRAs or other 401ks from other employers you may have, you know, legacy plans, legacy employers. But the current employer at which you're actively employed, even if it's part-time, you do not need to start taking RMDs from that 401k so long as you're still working there. Once you stop, then RMDs start. But Krishan's question is, so what if I'm consulting? I'm self-employed. I have a solo or individual 401k. Let's assume I'm still working as a self-employed person at age 75, 80, whatever, doesn't matter. Point is over 72. Can I delay required minimum distributions from my solo 401k? Short answer is no, unfortunately. One of the qualifying conditions that the IRS has implemented on this ability to delay RMDs from 401ks is you cannot own more than 5% of the company. If you do, this rule does not apply to you. You do need to start taking RMDs in the year 72. So if you are self-employed, you know, you're a solo business, you have a solo individual 401k, you own over 5% of your company, right? You own 100% or whatever. You know, it's clearly, it's a lot more than 5%. So with that said, no, this is not a plan from which you can delay RMDs because you own too much of it. So you will need to start taking RMDs from your solo 401k starting the year you turn 72, even if you are still consulting, still employed, you know, still making money, unfortunately. Good question, Krishnan. Next, a Social Security survivor benefit question from Scott. Thank you, Scott. Scott asks, if my wife takes her Social Security at 62 and I wait to take mine to my full retirement age or beyond, then when I pass, can she convert to mine, which would be higher, or is she locked into her Social Security amount? Thank you for your help. Great question, Scott. This is one a lot of people have, and this is a fairly common scenario. So, Scott, you start your benefit. Wait to take mine from range beyond. Okay. So yeah, you whether you delay or you start yours, point is your wife already started hers right at 62, let's say. You eventually predecease her. Let's assume you're, I don't know, I'm 68, just making up a number. Whether you started your benefit or not yet, Scott, when you pass, your wife will be able to take your benefit as a survivor benefit. Now, even though you didn't start it, she'd be able to get what you would have gotten had you started benefits at your passing, basically. So whatever amount you would have gotten at 68, you know, when you passed, that's what she'd be eligible to get as a survivor. Or if you were actually getting benefits when you passed, she'd be able to get that as a survivor benefit. Yes, she would be able to switch from whatever she's getting at the time from her own benefit to the survivor benefit. Now, if her own benefit is much smaller than yours, and there's no chance it's you know, it's going to grow if she were to stop hers and let it start growing again, if there's no chance hers is ever going to outpace yours, then yes, then she can stop hers, switch to yours, and continue getting yours for the rest of her life. Or if hers is larger, she can keep taking hers. She doesn't need to take yours. This is where things will get a little tricky. And without knowing your numbers, you know, I can't say this applies to you, but with survivor benefits, the spouse is able to basically pick and choose to keep getting their own benefit or take the spousal benefit. If they take the spousal benefit, they can in effect pause or suspend theirs, and that can, it can start growing again. So even though your wife took it at 62, she can pause hers and undo it, not undo it, but switch to yours. In the meantime, hers will start growing again. Now, what I don't know, and I'm thinking about it, I don't know if she needs to be full retirement age to do this suspension. Normally you do, you have to be full retirement age to suspend your benefit. But in the case of this, where you're switching to a survivor benefit, I don't know if you need to formally suspend under the having to wait the full retirement age, or if you can just simply pause it or suspend it once you start the survivor benefit. But either way, your wife could potentially let her benefit still grow as she switches to yours. And if hers ends up growing large enough that it becomes larger than the survivor benefit, then she can switch back to hers later and then stop the survivor benefit. So yes, what you're asking, Scott, is possible, is able to be done. Next, a question from a Facebook group, actually, that I thought was worth bringing up, partly because it's sort of like the yin to the yang of that solo 401k question that we had before, where that question was about delaying RMDs from a 401k. This question is about, can I still contribute to a 401k if I'm beyond RMD age? So I don't have the exact question in front of me, but the gist was someone is well in their 70s, still working by choice, they want to, at an employer that has a 401k. As we already touched on because of Krishan's question, this wasn't what the person asked, but just to make it clear, if the person's still working at that employer and they don't own more than 5%, they can still contribute to that person's, they can delay taking RMDs from that 401k so long as they're still working, even if they're 90 plus years old. But what if they want to still contribute? They're making money that they want to save still. Can they still contribute to the 401k even if they're over 72? The answer is yes. At least in terms of, as far as the IRS is concerned, yes. The IRS will not prohibit the employee from contributing to the 401k regardless of age if they're still working there. But the plan, the 401k, the company, the plan administrator can. It's up to them. I'm guessing they probably wouldn't restrict you, but I really don't know. You'd have to ask the plan administrator, hey, if I'm still working, I'm in my 70s, can I still contribute to this plan? Yes or no? See what they say. They may choose to say, no, you cannot. I believe it's within their authority and power to say no to that. Again, I think it would be rare that they say no, but it's worth asking. So theoretically, yes, you can still contribute. The IRS won't stop you, but your particular employer or employer plan might, just because that's how they chose to set the plan up. And finally, question, not really a question, but sort of a scenario about tax gain harvesting. You all may know about tax loss harvesting, which is if you have securities, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, what have you, in a regular taxable brokerage account, not an IRA, not a Roth, not an HSA, not something tax qualified, but a regular normal brokerage account. And you have losses, unrealized losses on positions, you can sell some of those, realize those losses, and those losses can help offset other realized gains you may have, or losses to some extent, typically up to $3,000 per year per tax return. Losses can help offset other income for the year and give you a little bit of a tax savings. That's tax loss harvesting in a nutshell. There's also tax gain harvesting. What does this mean? It could mean a few things, but what I'm going to refer to today is the fact that if your income is within certain levels, you can have some or all of your long-term capital gains and qualified dividend income be taxed at zero federally. At the state level, different story. Different states have different treatments of capital gains, may still be fully taxable there, but I'm just talking about federal level. If your total taxable income is within a certain range, any long-term capital gains or qualified dividends within it can be taxed at zero federally. So when does this come into play? Let's assume you have a brokerage account with a lot of appreciated securities that have a lot. Last year has been ugly, but if you bought this thing years ago, chances are, you're still up quite healthily, possibly. And you have really low income otherwise. You did not yet start Social Security, your pension's not on, you're not yet RMD age, so you're not forced to take out IRA money. It's possible. You have zero income or close to it. Maybe you have a little bit of bank interest, and maybe some dividends get thrown off your brokerage account, but that might be it. You can consciously sell some of these positions in your brokerage account, realize some of the gains, and if you keep the amount of realized gains below a certain level, they can all be taxed at zero federally, which is obviously cool, right? You take some gains off the table with zero tax on it federally. And if you still like the position, you still want to stay invested, you can turn around and rebuy that position instantly. And you're basically what's called resetting your basis. Let's say you originally bought this shares for $10 a share. Now it's $100. You sell off some of it, realize some gain. You turn around, immediately buy back some more shares at $100. Now your gains going forward on that position are based on the original price of 100, not based on 10. So you reset your cost basis so that your gains going forward now will be, there's less of them in total because you just took some off the table and realized it. So this gets a little tricky. Do I have a video on this? I think I have a video on it. I'll share it, put a link in the episode, in the show notes. But for this year, 2020, what year are we? We're in 2022. If your total taxable income, and in this case, this client, they were married and filed a joint return. If your total taxable income is below or up to $83,350, any portion of that that's long-term capital gains or qualified dividends will be taxed at zero federally. And now notice I said this is taxable income threshold. So this is net of your standard deduction. So for a typical married filing joint couple, standard deductions, $25,900. That's total gross income of $109,250. So let's assume you have truly zero other income from the year, no interest, no dividends, no nothing. You complete clean slate. You can sell positions in your brokerage account and realize up to $109,250 of long-term capital gains this year. If that's it, if that's your sole source of income and you're married filing joint, you will owe zero federal tax on that for the year. That's awesome. So let me just restate that. $109,250 of realized capital, long-term capital gains, not short-term, this has to be long-term, long-term capital gains, and you have no other income for the year and you're married and file a joint return, all of that will be taxed at zero federally. That is tax gain harvesting. So if you have a year of low income or you're otherwise trying to keep your income low, such as, for example, you're on Affordable Care Act insurance and you are intentionally trying to keep income low, you can use this to help give yourself a little bit of income and still stay below whatever threshold you're trying to hit, whatever. You know, as long as it's within that threshold I mentioned before, all of it is taxed at zero. So I'll leave that there. There's more to it. It can get fairly technical, and these limits do change every year. So depending when you hear this, this could be quite outdated. But tax gain harvesting is real. It is a potentially valuable way to take some gains off the table, pay zero tax on it federally, and reset your basis so that gains going forward, when you eventually sell more, will be smaller than they otherwise would have been. So this is a good tax planning opportunity for those where it makes sense and it fits into your situation. All right, is that it? That's it for the questions. I can talk more about Zeppelin if you want, but I think we're probably running up on time. Pink Floyd, quick comment about Pink Floyd. I'm not really a fan of Pink. I don't know why I thought about this. I'm not really a fan of Pink Floyd as a whole. Certain songs I really love, specifically the David Gilmour years, like On the Turning Away is probably my favorite Pink Floyd song, and it makes me cry every time I don't know why. It's just such a lovely song. I think when I first heard it, I was a sophomore in high school, and I don't know, that's kind of moody age, interesting developmental age. And I came across that song one night as I was like getting ready for bed, and it's just like, wow, the song, this is a really good song. So that stuck with me. And that's one of my favorite songs. I'm not much of a fan for the Roger Waters era stuff, though I have to admit, The Wall obviously is a iconic album. There's a lot of good stuff on it. But anyway, so I'm much more a fan of the David Gilmour Pink Floyd years, and sort of like with Zeppelin, I like the slower stuff like On the Turning Away and even Learning to Fly. All right, you probably don't care what I'm saying here. I made three different musical references and soaked up more time than I should have with this. So I will stop for today. I hope you enjoy this. As always, if you like this podcast and the things I sort of flap my gums about here, you'll like my other content sources, which are my Facebook group, Taxes and Retirement, my YouTube channel, Retirement Planning Demystified, and my monthly newsletter is Retirement Planning Insights. You can find links to all three of those in the notes of this episode. And finally, here's my grovel and shameless beg. If you do like and value and appreciate and learn and find interesting this podcast, I would greatly appreciate and be thankful if you were to take a little bit and write a review, leave a review, 5 stars, give a thumbs up, a like, whatever means of positive acknowledgement there may be for whatever podcast listening platform you use to listen to this glorious show known as Retirement Planning Education. All right, that's it. Thank you as always for listening. I will see you next time.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.